Hey everybody, a few quick, super quick updates. The Worldcon fundraiser is now $449 short of the final bit that I need to raise, which is really good. That means we now have only two milestones left. The 8th just opened, so we should have probably this month or next month we'll have do the recording for that. Other things that got opened up, there are some milestones that did open up in case you missed it. We're going to be looking at Prince of Darkness, which Usman Malik chose for us to watch for Shoot the Wisp, which is going to be really cool because I've never seen Prince of Darkness. So, there's some Encyclopedia Confectura things coming and some other stuff that is obviously coming. If you listen to the rather horrifying Highlander 2 episode that was picked for the Worldcon fundraiser, that was a Mike Martinez pain thing. So in any case, I just want to let you all know that. So if you could donate, that'd be really great. Even $5 is great. Other than that, we're rebooting the blog a bit starting next week, so should see hopefully more content. We'll see if that's going to be so. So other than that, I'm gonna shut up and let you guys get to this episode. I hope you enjoy it.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, the Shoot the Wiz subcast.
Babylon 5 Rewatch, Season 1.
Season 1, Discs 5 and 6?
5 and 6.
Science, yeah. Importance, baby.
Yeah. I'm Sean.
I'm Mike. Paul.
Oh, you guys did the wrong order. It's supposed to be Mike and then Paul.
Oh.
It doesn't matter. It's okay. I'm Sean, that's Mike, and that's Paul. We are finishing the whole season now. We're done. This is it. Babylon 5, Season 1, from way back in the ancient times of 1994. And we will have many thoughts. But we'll do a recap, sort of our general opinions of the whole season towards the end of this. But we'll start by just getting right to it. And let's start with the first episode of this particular sequence, which is on Disc 5, which is Legacies, Episode 17. I watched this early of last week, so it's kind of not as fresh as I'd like. But it's described rather vaguely as a Minbari military leader's dead body disappears on the station. Which is not exactly what happens, but okay, it's a good start. So let's get general reactions to this. I'll start with you, Mike. General reactions.
Yeah, so I had forgotten this episode a little bit, especially the Talia Ivanova plot, where we see her, the two of these women kind of fighting over a young woman who's just exhibiting telepathic abilities. And of course, Talia wants her to go to Psycor, and Ivanova, with her anti-Psycor baggage, wants to keep her as far out of and away from Psycor as possible. And there's a bit of kind of proxy warfare between the two of them that deepens their relationship through antagonism. So I locked onto that, but I also think there's cool heterogeneity in the culture of the Minbari, where we've mostly seen the religious perspective, and now we get a strong kind of voice and push from the military caste, where we see that all is not well on Minbar in terms of how everybody remembers the war, and this body becoming kind of a rallying point for certain factions in the Minbari to want to get some stuff going. So I think this has a good soup of different types of things, and it has the great storytelling device that I love to see is when you have an A plot and a B plot, you use the two to resolve one another, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, actually really smart on their part to do that, because sometimes B5 doesn't always do that. The B plot is just sort of like there, and so they do it here. But one thing I didn't want to note is that a previous episode, Delenn says, I can't remember, I think she says it to Sinclair, you know, there's the religious caste and the military caste, and people should generally be afraid when the two agree. Because it's sort of the religious caste kind of runs things, but it's when they agree that, you know, war is what happens. And I can't remember which episode that is, but it seemed like a really good that this was the sort of counterpoint. Because you can see how much Delenn and the military guy, oh god, what is his name?
Ali Narun.
There you go, that guy. Narun. You can see how much they disagree, not only in terms of just how things should be treated, in terms of the investigation, but even in the way in which they behave and act. I mean, Narun is sort of like, he's the kind of guy who says, I'm just going to get what I need done and I'm going to do it. And I don't care if I hurt anybody because I just have a mission. And it makes sense from a military perspective because it's like, if you have a mission, it doesn't really matter what kind of destruction, unless you have specific orders to the counter, you just go to finish the mission and you have one mission. It doesn't really matter how you get there as long as you get there. Sort of. I mean, but anyway, Paul.
Yeah. I like Mike, I had actually forgotten the B plot of this episode entirely. I've forgotten that Talia and Ivanova tangle over the telepath, and it is neat that the telepath does resolve the A plot. I really liked all the world building we got with the Minbari. We get to see the military side of the Minbari go full on. That whole part with the open gun ports is interesting, and Mike knows why, because that's happened before and not in happy ways. There's interesting bits with language, how people are titled and stylized. The whole little fact that the throwaway line that Bremer apparently changed castes. Who knew you could do that? Apparently he did. And when Delenn throws her weight around, is she scary? I mean, we get to see that towards the end, but yeah, she's scary when she decides to play top leader. Elite Narun never knew what hit him.
Well, and it's interesting because I forget the exact details, but there seems to be a big phenotypical difference in the kind of head bone structures.
I noticed that too
within the Minbari.
I said that early in the series. There apparently be at least a couple of them, at least three, as far as I can count. These seem to be the major two, elite Naruns and yeah.
Lenier too has it.
Yeah, Lenier has that same A and
yeah, the crackling. I mean, there are Delenn interesting ways in which I should say that, with the exception maybe of the Narn, I can't remember. I don't really think there are enough physical differences between the Narn. Maybe that the women are a little bit thinner, but I mean, even with something like, for example,
Centauri.
There you go, Centauri. The women typically don't have that big, like, weird sail for a headpiece. And I don't know if that's just sort of a genetic thing, or if it's sort of like a cultural thing and they just do that. But it seems like that's pretty much only men have the big sail, and women typically are, I think they're typically bald, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
It's a status style thing with the Centauri.
Okay.
We see that Londo is a traditionalist, which is why he has the full sail. He's also kind of high status. I wish that his hair got bigger as the series, kind of as his status increased, but that's not really the case.
He just needs bigger hair. It's already like only a few years outside the 80s, man. I mean, we don't need to go back that far. Also, would be unmanageable. Like, how does he get it to stick up? I mean, just imagine how much hair gel that guy uses.
It's his pride in the Centaurum that keeps the hair up.
That's it.
Oh, there are some sexual undertones there.
But that's for a later episode.
It is, but man, you went there. So I guess I did like that. Actually, Mike, you didn't really finish your point. Did you? Did you want to continue on that?
No, I'm happy to kind of roll on to general plot elements or whatever.
Okay. So I will say that I appreciated, on the one hand, that the Sinclair's narrative here, he has history with the deceased. I mean, he was at the battle where Sinclair was. We've already learned, but Delenn learns he knows much later, that he was taken onto their ship for reasons that aren't exactly 100% clear yet. But that battle, he fought against this particular general. So there is a sort of interesting undercurrent of sort of a military respect where it's, you know, we don't have to agree, but at the same time, I sort of respect him. And I found that touching at the end when he's clashed heads with this other military guy, Narun. But in the end, when Narun's sort of forced to apologize, Sinclair actually does the even more diplomatic thing, which is to sort of show his respects for the deceased, which I don't think Narun anticipates. He doesn't expect that this guy who's a human who fought against this guy would be capable of showing that level of respect. And I think there's a sort of honest exchange in that final moment, even though maybe some of the other aspects of the narrative are a little uneven with, in terms of the tone. But that moment I thought was particularly good.
That is a very touching moment, a bridge between human and Minbari cultures. Mike's biting his lip. That works really well and really shows the diplomat side of the commander.
Yeah. He's good at diplomacy. Why is he a military man? Why isn't he like the ultimate, you know,
diplomat? Sorry, Kit. Sorry.
He has deserved his position in a few ways in this show so far, and I think Babylon 5 is sometimes at its strongest when it's doing the storytelling about what Babylon 5 is supposed to be, that it is supposed to be that coming together place. And there's a lot of other politicking and kind of week by week plot that goes on. But in episodes like this, we do see the mission of Babylon 5 actually getting followed and carried out, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, because Babylon 5 is we haven't really explained, if you've never seen and you happen to be listening and you're not going to go watch the episode before you listen to this, that Babylon 5 is one of the stops that they've decided to sort of present the body of this deceased general. He's a general, right?
Elite. Shah Elite was his title.
Okay, basically Minbari general. And it's basically like an honorable practice. Like they take him to show him, and it's sort of like with the Pope, you know, when the Pope dies, people go and observe his body as a sign of respect. In this case, they move the body around and take him to key locations to sort of, so people can pay their respects. And Babylon 5 is one of the places that's picked for that to go, which goes right to that idea, which you were saying, Mike, that there's a mission to Babylon 5, and the Minbari understand that mission, I think. Maybe somewhat better than some of the others because they're a little bit more trying to cut each other's throats out. But that I think is another key point. I mean, it's one of those moments when we have that exchange of culture that we've seen on and off throughout the season. So like one of the earlier episodes when we see the religious practices, and they all sort of share their religions. And then there's even the, there was another exchange. I can't remember now. I just drew a blank in my brain. But in any case, I love when the series does this, when it goes into the sort of deeper underpinnings of the whatever culture we happen to be dealing with, and gives us a bit more to these people. It's best, I think, the series is strongest when it's doing that. I would say.
It definitely goes to the whole theme of what the Babylon 5 is meant for. Whether actually Babylon 5 always lives up to that or gets to do that is another matter entirely. But that's the ideal of Babylon 5, the vision. I mean, just like the opening narration, it says the goal to where humans and aliens can work together peacefully.
It's our last best chance for peace. Only it's Sinclair's voice, not my crappy voice. Because Sinclair's got that really deep man voice.
He's got the theater chops.
Indeed, he does, right? He could totally be king. We should do Babylon 5 Hamlet version. I feel like you could do that. There's enough people stabbing each other in the back. It could be like a Shakespeare play. Anyway, so the other thing that I guess I would talk about is, you know, we've already mentioned it, which is Alyssa Belladin and the Ivanova and Talia Winters sort of secondary plot. And one aspect of this I really, really appreciated was that this was an attempt to show almost a nuanced side to the Psi-Core. Before, like, this is the thing that drives me nuts about the Psi-Core, is almost any time the Psi-Core shows up, it's always clear that they're in the wrong. They're just They're not doing what is right in this instance. They're assholes, basically. Talia Winters is the only PsyCorp person I kind of like as a human being. And I mean that, like, literally, like, as a human being, she's a person that I would at least would be willing to be in a room with, who also happens to have psi powers, for short periods of time, I should say, because I don't want her in my head. But this is one of those moments when I think the series does something very interesting, where it's trying to show these two sides. Where Ivanova, we know some of her history because from previous episodes, we've talked about it, particularly the episode in which they basically threatened to go into her brain against her will to get her to turn against Sinclair. And here's sort of her very hardcore stance going against Talia's equally hard stance, and both of them kind of having to learn that maybe it's not about them. It's actually about this person, Alyssa. And she sort of figures it out at the end. And it's really hilarious. It's like all the diplomats are trying to manipulate Alyssa. And Alyssa's just like, every time she goes in their heads, she's like, they're creepy and weird because they're not human beings. But Mike has a hand, so jump in.
Yeah, something I was thinking about in this episode and then a little bit later on is why is there no assigned Babylon 5 telepath who's kind of on the Earth Force side? Because Talia Winters is a commercial telepath. She's right. Not like actually attached to any of the Earth Force organization. And I think that there's a missed opportunity to have either Talia in the chain of command with Sinclair, or to have a separate character who is that type of character, to give a little bit more of that nuance.
Is this explained at any point? I'm sorry, I totally just jumped over you, Paul.
No. I'm trying to remember if in the pilot, Mike, if Lita is Intellius spot or is she Earth Force? Do you remember? It's been a long time since I've seen the pilot.
Yeah.
In the pilot, Sean, there's a different telepath. Her name is Lita Alexander, and we'll get to meet her in the forthcoming season. She will return.
But I haven't seen the pilot.
Right,
but because that's not in this.
Right, I'm giving you that context, but I don't remember if she's in a commercial role like Talia is in the pilot, or if she is actually part of Earth Force staff. I don't remember offhand. It would be interesting to try to figure that out.
Wikipedia says in 2257 she was assigned as Babylon 5's first commercial telepath, so it does seem like she was supposed to be in the same position, which makes me wonder what JMS's thought process was in wanting to have commercial telepaths, but not to have an integration between PsyCorp and Earth Force. Because with a military like that, it seems like it would be really dumb to not have some embedded specialists.
My guess would be twofold. If it may not be explained in the series, I haven't seen it, so I'm guessing you guys don't think it's ever explained. But it seems to me there's got to be two reasons. One of them has to be the diplomatic reason, which is why would Earth Force bring on, where clearly in the Earth Force are rather aggressive individuals, into what is essentially a diplomatic space, where they might, well, in some cases, might intentionally get information they're not supposed to, because let's be honest, some of the PsyCorp people are like sociopaths who would do it just for the kicks. And I think like that's one aspect, is perhaps like in terms of its mission, it doesn't make sense that you would have sort of PsyCorp people there, maybe commercial ones who could be purchased by anybody and used for their services. And the other is, I wonder if it's also Ivanova, the presence there in order to secure Ivanova would not work.
Yeah, that would be slightly borne up by the fact that it doesn't seem like the other races have their designate telepaths on board.
Yeah.
Because if those are so powerful, especially if you're talking about anybody over like the P10 level, when we get into PsyCorp level of power, you know, the Centauri would obviously have one on hand all the time. If they regard Babylon 5 as a big deal, which at the start of the series they really don't. But you'd think that the Minbari would at least have one. And from an Earthport standpoint, for me, it's just an intelligence community failure to not have a resource on board who would liaise with Garibaldi. But this is kind of a world building sidetrack but it does kind of give context to what the roles of telepaths are in the society.
Mm. And it also might just be divided loyalties. They're so loyal to the psychoid that you really couldn't have them in the military without their loyalty to the military being questioned, because they've been raised by the psychoid so much.
But we do have that other guy from earlier in the season who is a liaison.
Mm.
But he initially basically just give – like he only reason he gets there is because to the point at which he wants to start questioning is because Sinclair basically manipulates him. And I think that's very blatant. Sinclair's manipulating him, perhaps for a good reason, but manipulating him nonetheless.
But no, But yeah, he is in Earth Force and he does work as a telepath. So yeah, so – why isn't Babylon 5 at one? Unless there may be some, again, here go world building again, maybe some agreement that we don't have telepaths as part of the representative groups. And that's just decided when they built Babylon 5. You can have a commercial one, but nothing else. So we don't have a telepath arms race, as you were saying, with all these powerful telepaths running around.
Which and reminds me.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. So go ahead.
Which reminds me of how much fun the sequence with Alyssa and the Narn were, where she gets the peek into Natoth's mind and gets that incredibly powerful sense of just how aggressively the Narn really, really, really want to have telepaths again.
Yeah.
And their specific motives for that, because here's access to closing the nuclear gap, kind of on a certain level, that they're a galactic player, but they're missing one of the biggest parts of the tools that a race would have to interact with one another militarily or from an espionage standpoint.
And to tease Sean and our listeners who haven't watched Babylon 5, the Narns don't have telepaths for a very good reason.
Yes.
Good reason? Or like good as in good for them, or good as in it's reasoned out.
Meaty story reasons.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because those are very different.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, I mean, the last thing that I would just say is, I'll kind of save it. I would just say there are some performance issues here that hurt me, but we'll talk about that in some later points. I think, but. Yeah, so I mean, I think you kind of mind that one. You want to move to the next one?
Yeah, because I think we can do Voice in the Wilderness all as one thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a two-parter. There's the two pieces to it. They're called The Voice in the Wilderness Part 1 and Part 2. Who would have thought? Very, very unique naming style. So in any case, this is the sequence in which we get the planet that Babylon 5 is orbiting around is starting to behave really weird. It's supposed to be uninhabited. People are thinking there's some weird seismic disturbances. Maybe the planet's going to, blow up. Turns out, nope, there's some crazy shit going down there, and there's missiles coming out and all kinds of weirdness. It turns out that there may have been a civilization there. Meanwhile, Delenn has an old friend who has come, and they're, having some hangout sessions, chillaxing, going to the spa, those kinds of things. And of course, these two things intersect eventually. We'll start with you, Mike. What did you want to sort of address with this one?
So this is really, for me, one of the big cheeseburgers of the season. When we get
burgers.
you kind of, from a budget perspective, with shows like this, science fiction shows, Battlestar Galactica is the same way, you kind of set up a stretch of four or five shows in your season with low budget requirements, and then you spend it all, like you spend calories on a diet, on a big juicy cheeseburger. So with this, we get space battles and we get FX with the shit, like with the station down on the planet and the lasers, and it really felt in some ways kind of TV movie-ish. And goes broad on the scale when we bring in the Earth Force ships and then the other aliens come in, and it's really space opera in a different kind of way than our diplomatic stuff that we've seen most of this season.
I just want to add also really, 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 really slow evasive maneuvers. Did anyone notice just how agonizingly slow that they move when they're trying not to get hit by missiles?
Well, they're not fighter planes.
It doesn't matter.
That's not fighter plane.
How did they escape at all? Like, they're just like, I'll do a barrel roll that takes 5 minutes and somehow magically evade all of those missiles that are not moving that slow. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a basic conceit in space combat that just has to be a gimme, because all the physics that I'm told about in terms of how space combat would work would be that it would be really boring and be from far, far away. And that's not as interesting.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That makes sense.
So if we're already in a gimme, I'm not going to be too grumpy about it. If a show gives me a certain set of constraints that it's going to follow and it's going to follow those constraints, then it's fine. Fighters are going to be dodgy and capital ships are going to be not.
If you say so, Mr. Underwood.
That's just my take. You're welcome to disagree and be wrong.
No. That's not how this works, sir. It's not how this works.
I'm just turning the tables on you.
You can't turn the tables on me. As we both know, no matter what, you are always wrong. Especially when it has to do with comics.
Paul, help!
I am never right, so I don't actually have a good dog in this fight. I'm always wrong.
That's not true.
Okay,
but I can't actually contradict you, because then I'm sort of confirming. Right, so shoot!
Paul, what do you think about this episode?
This is, as Mike says, the cheeseburger. Let's blow some money off our budget to show Babylon, all sorts of Babylon 5 coolness, space battles, the big machine, an interesting character whose road beckons into the sea, but he doesn't actually get there. We get some world building we get some history with Michael Garibaldi and his history back on Mars.
That's right.
And the B5 mantra from Ivanova. Ivanova is right. I will listen to Ivanova.
Oh.
people do not do this at their peril. And I noticed this time I picked up something I hadn't picked up the last time. We get a small bit of world building. It's a throwaway bit, but it makes me wonder. There's a reference to, this is no bronze tech world. You can swing around, which sounds like there's no prime directive in the Babylon 5 universe, and there must be stations out there where humans have contact with pre-Starflight aliens. I thought that was interesting. I was like, well, I'd never heard that before. I don't even think we ever see that, but it's like, that's interesting.
Because we know that the Centauri pseudo-uplifted the Narn into spacefaring. Into a spacefaring race.
Right. Is Earth doing that somewhere? I would like to see one of these colonies one day. What's life there like? I was thinking it kind of reminded me of a couple of old science fiction novels, like, say, or even relatively recent ones, like, say, Chera's Foreigner series or Pornell's Janissaries. Not Janissaries. King David's Spaceship. And all the other things where humans are dealing with aliens or humans which are much technologically lower than them, but or even like I did for Skippy and Fanny, the Planet Christian novels at El Sprague de Camp. It's like that must exist somewhere in the Babylon 5 universe. Otherwise, they wouldn't talk about swinging around like on some bronze tech world. So that must exist somewhere. Yeah. It just tickles me pink that there might be green skinned aliens with weird eyebrows somewhere in the Babylon 5 universe that humans have landed and put a colony on.
That actually made me think of the word for world is forest by Le Guin. Although that may not be an exact reference, but when it comes to a sort of spacefaring race meeting one that is not, or at least a more primitive one. But it does seem like that may be something that's going on, but I don't think it's possible for this, at least for season one, to ever confirm that, largely because the perspective is almost exclusively on Babylon 5, who, if I'm honest, through a lot of this series, Babylon 5's mission seems to not be the same one that Earth has.
Yes.
They seem to be very much at odds. Earth, in some cases, seems like it's very much does not give a crap if things it does may potentially lead to additional conflict. Whereas Sinclair is like, in some cases, in some episodes, almost desperate in trying to plead with politicians who always come off as kind of assholes, trying to plead with them for what is clearly the right decision. And it's sort of, I think, on Sinclair's part, just extremely frustrating because, of course, he's bound by the rules. In some cases that we saw with the union episode, he sort of found ways to get around it in sort of manipulating the language. But I feel like that is one of the things that, like, Sinclair probably wouldn't even know that's what's happening because they probably would never have told him. It would be one of those things, if they ever revealed this to Sinclair, he would be completely and utterly offended by it, I suspect. Just because it's an unequal power relationship between the Earth and it's sort of like, you know, I don't know. But Mike had a hand, so go for it, Mike.
And segue to Mars, which is another place where Earth Force's kind of stance on things is directly not lining up with the perspective and the opinion of people on Babylon 5. We get that Sinclair was born on Mars. We learn that Garibaldi spent time there and developed relationships there. And he's spending this two-parter trying to get in touch with this lost love of his that he left to come and be on Babylon 5. And we know that because it's the series that it's important that Garibaldi be there because he's part of the whole thing, but it personalizes the potential loss. And like, okay, well, we know that there was a Mars colony, but if there's no one that any of our mains care about on Mars, then it's just a general political problem. This really personalizes the situation for Garibaldi. We see him tapping to good and to really bad ends, his connections and relationships, where he goes to Talia Winters, who he's constantly hitting on, like not to hit on her, but because he needs a connection. He needs desperately to reach out to this woman who he kind of left behind and is now regretting it, hoping that he hasn't lost her entirely.
And that's something that's really important for one of the episodes that follows this two-parter, because I think this is the moment at which Talia and Garibaldi's relationship completely changes. Because you'll notice in one of the later episodes, they actually have a tender moment at the end because Talia Winters has to do something rather horrifying, which is basically to wipe somebody's mind. Or at least prep them for wiping. And so she has to go into a killer's mind. And she's particularly shaken up by it, and he sort of offers comfort in a romantic sense, in a very sort of like friendly dude person sense, I guess. I feel like this episode sort of leads us to that moment. And I did want to say too that that B5 does do this, at least in this sequence, this series, the first season, does try to do that a lot. I don't think it's always effective, where what you were saying, Mike, where it sort of tries to personalize issues that are not explicitly relevant to Babylon 5 or may not be something that's a serious issue there. So, for example, when we talked about the Homefront people, there was the episode in which I just can't remember names for the damn, but one of Ivanova's friends turns out to be a member of Homefront. And so that sort of sets the stage for that sort of personalized take. Because we see how it's affected her. It's affected somebody who's a main character here in a very direct sense. So it's sort of not detached. It's very much this is something that, in a way, hits home for
our
characters.
Grounding it into the characters. B5 is very good at doing that.
It's smart. You kind of have to do that.
Otherwise, these things just wash over the station crew and you don't ever really care.
Yeah, it's background noise. You know,
It's such a big and complex world that you can play the sociological SF angle and say, well, here's some social issues that are going on. But if it doesn't seem pressing to the people we care about, it's a lot less accessible. So Babylon 5 continually brings those issues home for our leads in a way that's occasionally like small world theory, in the same way that you get in like Lost or Heroes, where everything is ultimately about our leads. But I think it's largely excusable throughout this show because it's not too densely distributed, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, that whole, like, everybody seems to, we get the plot of the week coming in and somebody knows about it. I've mentioned that before on earlier episodes. It's a consequence of tying it into the characters, but it comes at being able to actually tie it in with the characters rather than just be fire and forget.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's the Mars thing, in which, Mars, or a segment of Mars, that sort of basically vied for independence from Earth, if I recall correctly. It's not Homefront. It's a totally different group, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's this subplot. So in case people are a little bit confused about what's happening. And then obviously if we go back to the when Sinclair and who the hell goes with him? Shoot.
Vonnova.
They actually go down to the planet where there's all this weird stuff happening. And turns out there's some sort of bizarre machine. It's this immense, complicated machine, which is basically hidden inside a planet. And the guy inside it is dying, hence why the planet is going, whoo-hoo, crazy. And what I loved about this is, on the one hand, it was like this really cool, big sci-fi idea of like a machine inside a planet, which is just really cool. But I also really liked this that narrative that comes at the end where the ship, one of the ships that's of the same alien species shows up, but it's not what we think. We're expecting like, oh, they've shown up, like they figured out he's here, and it's like, oh, hey, we're like long lost dude, what's up? No, it's they're exiles from whatever's left of that species and have been looking for this machine because it can be used as a weapon rather than as this guy has been using it as sort of a hiding it and I guess presumably for knowledge and protection, which I love that narrative. And it's also one of the few moments when we actually get to deal in this series with people actually having to learn English. And because that's something that's sort of a gimme for either they just don't speak English or they do and that's the end of it. But here, like, they've had to analyze their language files and have had to figure out how to speak some version of English that makes sense. So I really enjoyed it. I thought that was really cool. However, I did forget to mention that there is the military guy in this who shows up with his big ship.
The Hyperion.
The Hyperion, which is a cool name for a ship. That's pretty badass.
I have that noted down too.
The thing that I did not like about this is a thing that I have a problem with that B5 does too often, which is it is too easy for us to side with the main characters on issues that occur in the show. Because the secondary characters that produce conflict are almost always almost like caricatures. They're very simplified, not a lot of nuance. And that's too often that this occurs. And in this episode, that's exactly what happens. I mean, it seemed immediately clear to me. This military guy shows up. He is just a raging asshole. He is rude and condescending. He just like has disdain on his face. At no point does this guy seem even interested in trying to sort of understand Sinclair's position whatsoever. And so for me, I felt like there was no way I could ever think that this guy might be right in his decisions. It always seemed to me he's wrong. And so it made it very difficult for me to sort of, the only reason I could sort of accept that they work together in the end is out of just desperation. That's the only reason. Otherwise, I mean, I just can't imagine Sinclair working with him in any serious sense unless he's forced to. Because why would he? This guy for me seems clearly on the wrong side. And Mike's going to disagree with me right now.
Yep, it's my job.
I hate you so much.
I eat your hate like cheeseburgers.
Like cheeseburgers, of course.
Like cheeseburgers. From this guy's perspective, he's jumping in to a hot system where the planet is basically a space nuke. And it's probably best if a space nuke gets seized, controlled, and understood immediately. Because you don't want your gigantic military asset on the edge of space to get blown up by a space nuke. Instead, you want the space nuke to become your point defense system for your space outpost. So the military objective here, I think, is very clear. The guy doesn't have a nuanced perspective on things because he's not a nuanced perspective dude. He's a warship commander. And yeah, they probably should have kind of talked like people who are in the same command structure a little bit more effectively. And that's one of the places where Babylon 5 does make the apparatus play and gets a little bit broad at times.
Yeah. I guess what I would like, I just you choose another example. Like let's take Battlestar Galactica, which is maybe a little bit unfair because it comes much later and narrative film changes a bit, but let's take, for example, bloody hell. What is her name?
Rosalyn.
No. Military commander, Kane.
Oh, yeah, Admiral Kane.
Admiral Kane, right. So she shows up, and right off the bat, she starts by seeming Miss Friendly Lady, right? But then it turns out she's actually here to muck with things. She's going to muck with the command structure. She's going to mess with things a bit. which perhaps expected. But once we start to understand why she does the thing that she does, we understand why she is so aggressive in what she does. And while we don't have to agree with her, we at least understand the motivation. Whereas in this case, for me, it was so thin. Like, beyond the simple fact, like, well, he's just a military guy in a warship, that's the reason. That's not enough for me. I need more. I need to know more about why he behaves the manner he does. Why isn't he somewhat more diplomatic? I mean, other military people are. Sinclair is a military guy. He's capable of some degree of diplomacy in situations involving violence. Granted, he's also in a position where he needs to be somewhat diplomatic in general. There's this moment where I recognize that this guy may be an asshole for a reason, but they're not telling me why. And I need that information because otherwise I can't sympathize with him. I feel very disconnected.
I'm going to defend Captain Pierce a little bit here.
Sorry. One of dead.
As Michael implied, I mean, look at it from Captain Pierce's perspective. He's a military commander. Babylon 5 has sent out messages about there's hostile force on this planet shooting missiles at things. He's not thinking that there's any intelligence or anything to be diplomatic about here. There's an automated defense system. There's high technology. Earth needs high technology. I mean, 10 years ago, they nearly got wiped out to extinction by the Minbari. And now there's a planet underneath Babylon 5 with high technology. Of course I'm going to tap that. And yes, and the diplomat's just going to get in my way. So yes, I'm going to bolt forward and try to take this because this is what Earth needs, and the diplomats is going to slow us down, maybe enough that the Centauri or the Narns or somebody will come in and grab it first. And that cannot be allowed. So action is key. He acts. Yes, he looks like an asshat, but from his perspective, he's doing absolutely the right thing.
Well, okay, I will say one, I don't know what his perspective is because we don't really follow his character. Two, yes, he does want to take action. I can understand why he would want to take action. There may be perfectly good reasons for that. However, he is a military man, which means he should be smart enough to listen to people who are trying to give him valuable information that could affect the safety of his men. And he doesn't. He completely ignores Sinclair. Sinclair has been doing this particular job a lot longer than this fool has. Because this fool is not running Babylon 5. Sinclair has a certain degree of knowledge, which he should be using. He should be using it so that even though he's going to go down there, he can at least do it safely. But he doesn't. He completely blows off Sinclair. He says, whatever, Sinclair, you're just a weird guy. We got to stop all these other guys from getting it. So we're going to send stuff down, even though Sinclair's like, don't do it because the planet's going to like fucking blow up. And that's bad news for everybody. And so what does he do? He sends his ships to go do it. And what happens? A whole bunch of his men get shot. They don't get killed, thankfully. They get disabled. But that's what he does. And that's the problem is, yes, he has a perspective, whatever it may be. I don't really understand what it is because there's not enough of his character. But that perspective is one which is so irrational and so paranoid and so douchey and just so aggressive that it's hard to even believe that he has become a commander of a ship in comparison to Sinclair, who actually is quite smart. He knows when to act, when not to act. He knows when he needs extra information. And when he makes mistakes, he does own up to them, but he doesn't make a lot of mistakes that like lead to whole ships getting blown up, which this guy almost does. So that would be my take on that. So okay. I don't like him. He's an idiot. I hope he loses the Hyperion because I want to fly it. So yeah. I do. I want my own laser ship. That's awesome.
I'd rather have a Minbari ship.
Well, yeah.
That's true. Yeah, that'd be kind of cool too.
Something we should keep an eye on is whether the names of the Earth Force ships are all mythologies. Because I remember mostly Greco-Roman, but I forget if they have like the Amaterasu later on in the show or something. Because it'd be cool if it was mythological figures from around the world on the capital ships.
That's a good point. I bet you there's a list somewhere.
Yes.
Babylon 5 ships. Just Googling it.
Do we want to wrap this one up and get on to the next?
You know, let's move on to B Squared.
All right. Next episode, Babylon Squared, which is actually a weird episode. In this episode, some weird sort of time bubble appears. There's some stuff that's being revealed about a future that's coming. But basically, Babylon 4, which is supposedly had disappeared and is presumed gone, mysteriously appears in a nearby sector. And sort of the Babylon 5 people sort of discover the signal and they go to check it out. They realize it's Babylon 4 and that they're from the past, bubbling into the future. And so it's sort of this bizarre story of trying to figure out what's going on here. And at the same time, the characters having Garibaldi and Sinclair having flashbacks or flash sideways. Actually, flash sideways may be better because it wasn't clear to me that those were necessarily the futures to come per se, although they may be. But it was not clear to me in this that that's necessarily what was true.
Yeah.
So it seemed like these were possible futures. But who knows? So yeah, it involves a time traveling astronaut in an oversized suit, which is cool.
We will find out who that is in good. Well, we do find out who he is.
At
the end of the episode.
Well, yeah, we'll
find out
reveals
why
it.
He's like that. We'll find out why he's there.
With his new wife, Delenn.
This episode is is twinned to an episode later in the series. So it's really fun to go back and watch this, having seen that twin episode later on, because they fit together quite well. And I love when, like, if you're going to do time travel, it's got to be seamless. Otherwise, I'm going to get really annoyed. Because I've seen enough time travel stuff that I want it all to make sense with kind of as much as possible. So this does a good job bearing it up. And we get Zathras!
Yes!
Not the one.
Oh, on the ship names, by the way, no, there is no mythological per se.
Oh.
Hyperion is a ship class. There is an actual Hyperion. Then there's Excalibur, Clarkstown, Aegean, Lexington, Prometheus. So, like, mythical and sort of a broad interpretation.
So, like, mythical and legendary.
Yeah, yeah, that would be more.
But it does seem like they're mostly Western.
Yeah, which is disappointing. But,
you know, I would have loved to see the carrier ship Egun.
Oh, well, here we go. Acheron, Achilles, Agamemnon, Agrippa, Alexander, Anubis, Apollo, Cadmus, Cerberus, Charon, Churchill. There's a Churchill.
This is all Western, west of Egypt.
Not
Anubis isn't.
Anubis is Egyptian.
Egypt and west. It's all that corner. It's all Mediterranean and Western Europe.
Yeah, there's no East Asian, South Asian, South Pacific.
There's a ship named after Pornell. That's fun. Cool, right?
In any case, we totally went sideways. Geek digression.
Yeah, it was total geek digression. Cool names, though. Yeah. But in any case, so who wants to general reaction for this episode?
I will jump in. It as Mike said, that the last time I saw this, I saw the other half of this episode, and so it was nice to see the front half of this episode and how it connects in. Although I think, given what they had to do with the series, Mike, I think they did have to make that second episode tweak a little bit to make it fit with this one, because I'm sure this was when JMS wrote and directed this episode, he had a slightly different thing in mind for that back half, and he had just to fix that. He had to tweak that back half to make it work after circumstances change. Which
there is that.
I know I'm being deliberately obscure, but I don't want to give away any spoilers. I noticed specifically this time that Babylon 4's lighting palette is distinctly different, so you know you're on Babylon 4, not on Babylon 5. It's that nice green lighting. I thought that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
So you just didn't think you were on Babylon 5 again? I mean, as well as it looking wrecked, the lighting looks distinctly distant. We get another great council moment, and of course we get Zathras.
Is this the one where Delenn turns down her job, or does that come later?
This is the one where Delenn turns down the job. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, they want to promote her to
head of the great council. Basically. The head of Minbar, for all intents and purposes.
And the item that she's given at the end of the episode is one that we've seen before in the series.
Mm.
In a flashback.
Yeah, right, with Sinclair's flashback.
Sinclair's flashback. Yep. So that kind of gives some extra weight to what it is that she's going to do with that thing and kind of helps tie together some of the deep mythology of the series.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, I remember that detail from much earlier in the season. And it is interesting that this is... this is something I find interesting for Delenn, because Delenn is a character who's very much driven by... I want to say convictions, but I feel like convictions is the wrong word.
Belief,
maybe, but it feels... Belief just feels wishy-washy. But she's driven. She has a sense that something greater is happening here, and that she must follow her calling, whatever that calling may be. And I feel like she is the one character here who is most driven by that kind of a conviction of one's calling, that she's even willing to throw something like the Great Council away on the basis that that's not where she needs to be, even though this may hurt her. It doesn't in this case. They say that it could hurt her, because it's sort of, I guess, a fence to sort of deny entry. But I do really appreciate that's Delenn's character is very much driven by something that I don't think we even fully understand by the end of this series. Because when we get to the final episode, I don't think Chrysalis, I don't think, tells us at all what is to come, except that we have hints that the shit's going down. I like that aspect of this episode. I also like that we have like time travel, which is cool, and it's handled much better than having like a giant flying Q.
Giant flying Q?
Yeah, Star Trek reference.
Oh, right.
Q's fun, but he's only fun for a little bit, and then he just gets really annoying.
Yeah.
Zathras knows what you what you did there. Zathras knows.
Yeah, I love Zathras too. He's a fun character.
This is not the first time we will see it. Last time we'll see Zathras, thankfully.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't have anything else to say about this episode.
It's kind of hard to just to dive into, because you haven't seen the last half, and B, it'll be basically, yeah, this is one half of a story, so it's kind of sits on a leg for the moment.
I do love the big F-off aliens chain gun that Garibaldi has in one of the Flash Sideways.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's great.
I love how he's screaming at him. He's like, come get some! Come get some!
You want
like,
some?
He's in a war movie for one scene.
He must have had so much fun in Jared Doyle.
This is what I was born for. And he clearly looked like he was born to take a souped-up chain gun against aliens.
Yeah, and boy, is he going to need it, because I know some shit's going down.
Yep. Moving on.
Do we want to continue this one or do the next one?
I think we're ready for Quality of Mercy.
All right. I would just say that I hate this episode.
You hate this episode? You hate this episode?
There are a couple episodes I hate in this series. I hate this episode only for one reason, and it's not the episode's fault. The reason why I hate this episode is because... as soon as the show starts to give us these hints about what's to come, it just throws in some random episode that has nothing to do with the series, this sort of narrative, and it just sort of, poof, whatevs, all that momentum gone, and now we're going back to some random episode about some lady in the bottom of the ship using an alien device to heal people, and Dr. Franklin's upset. But it doesn't have any direct connection to anything else, as far as I can tell, and I'm just... I hate that. I can't stand it, because I'm so, like, I was on the edge of my seat. I was like, wait, Sinclair from the future is, like, hanging out in, like, space-time, and he's like Doctor Who, the American version? What's going on here? I'm really excited. And then it's like, mer, mer, mer. Sad, depressed cancer patients. Yeah, I'm just like, come on.
I like... Lanier's one of my favorite characters. I've been compared to Lanier. So this is a heavy Lanier episode where we get to see Lanier's innocence. So I like it for that reason. There's also, and this is really deep ahead, I think 3 years from now, the whole bit with there's the dimension of why the doctor lost her job that will be important several years from now, because someone else will go through the same thing.
Hmm.
Because they talk about stim addiction, there will be a character in this series that goes through that. I think you could probably guess who.
Garibaldi. Addictive son of a bitch.
So
he is driven.
So we dropped that hint that this could happen, but it's a buried hint in the episode. And I mean, the alien machine. I mean, I don't even know if we ever see it again, Mike. Do we ever see this darn thing again?
I thought it comes up like once, but it is definitely more of a one shot kind of item, which seems a little bit lazy considering how powerful it can be. If they had just junked it at the end, that might have been a little bit stronger.
That might have been a better ending if it had just burned out by the end. But I love the poor linear. Like, yeah, alcohol, small amounts of alcohol make me psychotically violent.
I love it because there is some of that comedy, which is really cute. Like, I don't know why, but Londo has the best relationships with people. He just has great friends, and Linear's just awesome.
He's a diplomat. It's his job.
Well, yeah, but you know.
But yeah, he's a very particular type.
Yeah.
Of diplomat, and I think is just an incredibly well-drawn, spiky character. Like, he presents very clearly right away in this show, so that we then know where he's started and what kind of a person he is, which means that as he changes throughout the series, there's a clear shape to his journey, which I love.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's just adorable.
We've just begun it, yeah. We've just begun that.
And he's adorable.
And in purple, he is stunning.
In purple, he is stunning.
Also funny and adorable. Yeah, so I mean, that was a fun little subplot, the sort of Linear and Londo taking on the town. And I love at the end, the really adorable moment when, well, a number of things we learn. We also learn about Centauri penises in this.
Yes!
Which we'll probably have to have a long Freudian psychology sort of discussion about that in a minute. But I love at the end of the episode, like, even though I hated this episode, it was not because it was the episode's fault. The episode itself is fine. It's just where it sticks in the structure of the season that I just didn't like. But there are a couple things I love. One is at the very end when Sinclair's like, so you beat the crap out of like 2 dozen people, or like what happened? Like you saw 2 dozen people and you were involved in the incident. Everyone says it's your fault. And Londo's like, and Lanier is like, well, it's all my fault because I misunderstood the rules of the game of poker, which is totally fair, and started an altercation and then beat the crap out of a bunch of people. And then, of course, what we learn is Centauri penises are apparently long tentacle-like things with sticky ends. That sounds really horrible when it comes out of my mouth that I say that. Oh, my God. Which... I was hoping, gosh, I was just hoping he had some sort of weird stomach parasite, and that was like he was just keeping it around because it was a cute pet. But no, it's his Centauri penis. And apparently he was trying to cheat with cards using his Centauri penis.
Well, when you have prehensile genitalia that most people don't know about.
I guess you could use it for that.
Did you think these were just decoration?
Yeah, and it does remind us that the Centauri are not so close to human as we think, that their kind of biological difference is more concealed than say the Narn or the Minbari, but that they are in at least this way very, very different from humans.
Just out of curiosity, is it fair to suggest that the Narn are perhaps less interested in keeping the sexy time within the species? Because they're, I mean, obviously the Narn in, I think it's the next episode.
Crystalis, yes.
Jakar is like shown basically humping three people. Well, he's not shown doing it. They walk out of his room and that's the implication of what they were doing. I'm sure didn't have them over for tea. So, but with Lanier, Londo, I only recall ever seeing him with other Centauri women, but I guess
but he does ogle the human woman in this one.
Okay,
the dancer. So he clearly finds the human female form interesting.
Well, okay. So the question I now have
is Lanier, which is interesting, but and that doesn't really play come into part until later seasons. But
so does it make me a pervert to wonder how sex works for them?
No.
Okay.
I wondered after seeing this episode years ago, like, so it goes into what? Yeah.
So what
term,
do women
the
have?
The term is xenophile.
Yeah, xenophile. So what do the women have? Because it's like
they,
the dudes
have
like... Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
According to the JMS notes, the women have ports or openings in their back that correspond.
So what happens if you punch one in the back? Do they, like, get hurt?
That is a question that be asked.
Would it eat your hand?
Yeah, so the
note
says...
ports, so more than one.
Yeah, Centauri females have 6 narrow slots in their back, 3 on either side of the spine, right around the base of the spine. So ostensibly, Centauri males have 6 of these tentacles.
Do you need all 6?
We did see multiple ones on that statue.
Yep.
So does that mean like they don't have the other genitalia then? Is that the
assumption? That is their genitalia.
They need like this? It's very anthropocentric of you, Sean.
I'm genuinely curious, not only how Centauri do it, but now also how would a Centauri and like a human do it?
Right.
Like, I know I'm like genuinely curious now. Like, I know that it's somewhat disturbing, but I want instructional videos now.
Well, you can go to the internet and find fan fiction for that, I'm sure.
I want instructional videos.
The internet will provide. That might even provide that.
I want Straczynski to make me some instructional videos. I want to know. Because at least Alien Nation actually explains this, how they humans and aliens do it. In this, it's never explained, and I'm just, like, really curious. Because it's got to be really complicated.
Sure, but that's not the kind of show that they're going for, necessarily.
Well, maybe they should have thought about that before they made this episode.
Well, when Paramount hires me to do the reboot in 20 years, I will think about that, and I will bring you on to investigate all of the various parasexual relationships.
Oh my gosh, I would have so much fun.
Special consultant.
Special consultant. I like that. Of course, what they'll find out is special consultant on cross-species sex.
That
awesome.
Could be useful.
You could be.
But anyway, there's also this telepath plot.
But anyway, yes, there's also this telepath plot.
Wait, which telepath plot?
The death of personality.
Oh,
death of
right, personality. Right. Yeah, yeah, that was really cool.
Creating a new personality, yeah. Which, again, is also, in a weird way, a foreshadowing, I think, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, yes, we're being mysterious again, Sean. Yes.
Vague vague podcasting. Was it vague casting, I guess?
Vague casting.
Well, yeah, so I actually liked the idea of this, although I felt like it's something that needed a little bit more development, and I think that's just limitations of the format for now. But I really liked that this was considered the less serious crime than spacing someone, which I took to mean throwing them out the airlock.
That's spacing.
That taking somebody's mind away and basically inserting a new personality, which, whoa, hello, sci-fi, that is considered less horrifying in terms of the morality of this world than just shoving someone out the airlock. Because in my mind, the more horrifying one is having yourself emptied out and have something else stuck in. But that's because I live in a world where this doesn't exist.
Well, it's basically capital punishment with the possibility of you as a body contributing to society, even if you as a person does not.
Well,
which
right,
is,
yeah.
Which is creepy, but I can see the social angle to it.
It's super creepy, though. I mean, and I, that's like the simplistic answer. It's just creepy what has to be done. And Dahlia Winters is not happy about having to do it. For, I suspect, fairly obvious reasons, which is it's just that's incredibly uncomfortable.
Yeah, when she goes into his mind and she realizes how many people he did kill, yeah. That is really disturbing.
And what's the creepy way in which they do it, like he's like a Hannibal villain. You know, he's just like, yeah. I need to kill people so that I can take their voices for my symphony, basically.
Yeah.
And that's like, that is super creeps.
But yeah, this really needed a longer episode. I mean, he breaks free, then he gets captured, and it's all very short and compressed into one episode. That it would have been nice to have more.
Yeah.
It does feel a little quick and rushed.
Well, he doesn't get captured. He gets killed. He gets killed by the woman in the down below. This is stuff we haven't talked about.
Right.
So like, Franklin goes down into down below, the lower end of the ship, and he basically just provide free medical services for people who can't otherwise afford it, right? Because that's what his job is. And he tells other people that's his thing, right? He's going to help people. And what he discovers is he's losing patients to somebody who has some sort of alien device who he assumes is a quack. But it's a woman with a very rare disease that's killing her, and is basically taking on other people's pains and ailments to help heal them through this machine. That's what the machine does. It's a form of corporal punishment, we learn later. And so when this guy, this bald-headed, symphony-loving weirdo who kills people, shows up, and it's sort of discovered that that's what's happening. When Franklin walks in, he finds out that's what's going on. She basically transfers everything of her own pain to him and kills him in the process.
And heals herself
in the process. And I think it's really right that at the end of that, it does not take the easy way out, which would have been to just been like, she's going to go on vacation and she's going to retire and everything's going to be awesome and she's going to like see the beach. But rather they go with the option where, no, she now has her own mission, because unlike the other guy, who is he's like a serial killer. He kills people for no good reason. He's just does horrible things to people. She's killed somebody out of desperation, but that, unlike what Franklin tries to convince her of, she recognizes that it's still wrong and she has to make penance. And that even though she is technically legally not required to do so, she's going to do so anyway to sort of make up for it. And I like that that's the end for her, at least in this episode. I don't know if she ever shows up again. I doubt it, but...
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well, unfortunate, because she'd be kind of cool. She could be like Franklin's wingman. It'd be kind of awesome. They could go trolling the bars together. It'd be great. Although he's going to be dating her daughter, so there's that. I appreciated that it took the tougher way out.
Yeah, she even has to go – she basically has to have a hearing. I mean, it's not just like, oh, he's dead, blah, 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 blah. No, she actually has – it's clear that she actually had a full trip through the justice system to decide that.
That's right. Yeah, she goes before the court.
Yeah.
I mean, unlike in certain states where you have to get public outcry for you to get put in front of the court.
I stood my ground. Oh, wait.
Yeah. In this world, you actually, you know, they look at the evidence and then they make the right call, obviously, because she's in a desperate situation. But yeah, so... clearly, Babylon 5 was not thinking about the possibility of Stand Your Ground, because that would have been a very different world. I think that's everything I got to say on that. You guys, anything else? Or
No.
All right, time for Chrysalis, the last one.
Where
shit gets real. Yeah. Oh God, I'm never doing that again. That was terrible. So Chrysalis, just a lot of stuff goes wrong. So Garibaldi's investigating a death of, I think he's like a junkie. I think that's the implication. He's like a junkie or something.
He's also an informant.
Yeah, he's also an informant.
Also an informant. So Garibaldi's investigating. This, of course, ties into a larger plot to kill the president, which Garibaldi discovers, but Garibaldi gets injured in the process. There's also Delenn, who... in some sort of mysterious version of 20 questions down to reduced to one, gets the answer of yes from
Kosh,
and then decides to go through a very strange process, which I don't think any of us were expecting, which is why the thing is called Chrysalis.
There was a hint a couple episodes back when the young telepath Lisa touched her mind, she came up Because the commander wanted info on what Delenn had in her mind, and she said, "Well, one more thing, Chrysalis. What's a Chrysalis?"
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So that was the foreshadowing for this.
And then the other plot is the conflict between Jakar and Londo, and more particularly the Narn Empire versus the Centauri one, continues. And in this case, we get the Morton returns, and basically does what Londo wants, but isn't willing to ask for, and in fact feels horrible that he wanted it. I think that's the implication, at least. And over a settlement on the edge of Centauri space, or the edge of Narn space, I can't remember which inevitably gets destroyed, ushering in what is, I imagine, the major point for the seasons to follow, which is some sort of mysterious new species that's like practically invisible.
You did see what kind of ships those were that attacked the Narn station, right? You were watching carefully.
Were they the same kinds of ship at that weird episode where the
with the eye?
Ding ding ding.
With the eye.
With the eye, remember the one that destroyed artifact? The Raiders? Remember you had asked if we see those ships again? With the jewel that gets stolen by the Raiders. And then those mysterious ships show up and destroy this Raiders? Remember you asked about those ships?
Yeah, I now remember. Okay, gotcha.
Same kind of ships.
Yeah, well, Morton apparently has, like, he's, like, sleeping with the bug creatures. And they look like bugs based on the, yeah. Oh, come on, he's totally getting it on. He's not getting any from humans.
I've never heard that before.
Totally. He hangs out with them all the time. So what else, what do you think he's going to do? Man's got needs. It's a simple exchange of cultural fluids.
This episode is way pervier than I was expecting.
I'm sorry. We had an episode with Centauri tentacle penises that have sticky suction cups. It's like tentacle penises.
I'm being nibbled to death by cats here.
That's but this
episode has some classic tropes. It's got the classic dying man trying to give the message and fails. We have the classic shot in the back trope. And yep. The mole inside the organization. We get the mysterious raiders destroying the Narn outpost.
Yeah,
I mean, there's lots of meaty stuff in this episode. I mean, and that whole last bit of Garibaldi being shot, and then kind of paralleling what happened at the beginning with Petrov crying to get to safety to give his message.
Yeah, same thing. And of course, what does Garibaldi do? Like a badass, he crawls to the elevator.
Yep.
Because he's awesome.
He's got more hit points and he's a major character.
Yeah, well, that's true too. I mean, I love it. And I love, once again, we get Jakar and Londo just at each other's throats. I mean, they just won't give in. And I think that's just largely because that conflict. I mean, Sinclair, I think, is desperate, even though Jakar agrees with Sinclair, but Sinclair basically comes in and is like, you guys are just, you're just going down this path and it's not going to be a fun place to go. And you should like really start thinking about the diplomatic solutions here. Because otherwise it's not going to be fun. It's not going to be happy fun time. And he agrees later, but I love the conflict. And, obviously, Jakar is really intelligent because of course he figures out that it could not possibly be the Centauri that did it. He rightly so, and I think is a hint that comes later, because if you remember that episode where the Sinclair's now going to be wife goes on that survey mission to a system that Jakar tells her not to go to,
and
Jakar says there are all these mysteries in the world and that kind of stuff, that seemed like in weird way foreshadowing this episode.
In some ways, yeah.
Yeah,
it's clear that Jakar, you know, the whole Babylon 5 universe is much deeper, and there's many darker corners and hidden mysteries in the universe than you'd think just from looking at the station. I mean, the universe outside of it is clearly a much wilder and weirder place.
Absolutely, yeah. And in this case, that's exactly where he goes. He goes to the place where, you know, in his mind, where it's no, this is not the answer that you'd think. It's the answer that nobody wants to think, which is we're not alone, as in we're not alone with the people we know exist. There is some other crazy shit out there, and it's not going to be a friend. So I appreciated that. I also like that Londo feels particularly bad about what happened, although presumably not bad enough to say anything. Hint, hint, wink, wink.
Well, what was he going to say? Oh, Commander, I have a special friend who killed the 10,000 Narn. Like, he, and not to mention, this is giving Londo exactly what he wants.
Well, yeah.
I mean, overkill and fire and blood, but it's giving Mondo exactly what he wants for the Centauri.
And the funny thing is that he's getting what he wants, but not under his control. He's like, he has specific objectives. He has tactical desires with a larger strategy, but that the hand is being played by someone else. So he's, as he's wielding power, he's also becoming something of a pawn, and he's going to have to come to grips with his changing role within the galactic political landscape. And looking back at the start of the season with, I think Ragesh 3 is the thing at the very beginning, we already see kind of some of the trajectory that he's on and will continue along.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean,
Ragesh 3, he was relatively helpless, and here he's a player and being played.
Yep.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, he acknowledges that's what's happening too. He probably knows it now, or at least that's the impression I get. But yeah, it's a good end of the season.
And of course, the president dies.
Oh, that's right, the president dies, and they try in vain to stop him.
Yep.
From happening, and then he blows up.
So we know it's not an overloaded fusion reactor accident. We know right from the start that this was deliberate.
Yep, but this is also one of those moments where I just want to hit the politicians, because I feel like here is a guy who's like, Sinclair is not a chump. Like, they didn't send him out here because he was annoying, but they couldn't fire him, like, and so they just sent him out there because he's kind of crazy. No. Sinclair's a respected man. And so when he's saying, like, my people may have uncovered a plot, and they're just like, no, it's just that thing. Whatever. Like, you need to just shut up, and if you keep talking about this, I'm going to bury you in the sand. I find that just really hard to take, because I don't know if it doesn't seem believable to me.
It feels like it is a bit of a sweeping under the rug, and in retrospect, what happens next season almost feels, I don't know if Mike, you feel this way, almost feels like kind of they decided to deal with Sinclair, not with the entire staff, but they decided to deal with Sinclair. What do you think, Mike, by what happens to Sinclair?
My understanding is that that was largely just the casting.
Just the casting rather than plotting? Okay.
Yeah, that my understanding, scuttlebutt-wise, is that the actor who played Sinclair didn't want to hack the 22-episode season because he was mostly a stage guy. So he stepped down or talked to JMS, and they decided to make a change.
Well, thank you for ruining that for me, guys.
It happens in the very next episode.
Very next
Thanks
episode.
Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks a lot. Thank you so much for ruining everything.
He will be back. As you, I mean, if for no other reason, you've seen Babylon Square, you know he will be back. He must be back.
I'm totally not happy now. Okay, I guess we get Bruce Boxleitner, so.
Oh, but see, I mean, yeah, it's not exactly unknown. Yes, we will get Bruce Boxleitner.
Yeah. And it's not the two characters are not the same, which I think is very interesting. Because it resets a lot of the character dynamics, which we'll see when we get into season two.
Which we're never getting to now.
But because now you're going to throw a hissy fit?
I am going to throw a hissy fit because you ruined the show for me now.
Well, there's other cool things we could watch. We could watch Battlestar Galactica and be depressed all the time.
We could
watch The Prisoner.
But I won't be depressed because I will just be gushing with joy through all of it. So that show's amazing. Best sci-fi show ever made.
Yeah. I praise. Well, so do we have any other kind of season-wide thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, like, well, it'd be a good time to sort of recap our general opinions, and I think it'd be a good idea to grade the whole season. Because we usually grade films, so why not grade a whole season of a show?
Okay,
Wait, we don't have to do that yet. We should recap. Recap first.
Okay, I will recap first.
Recap first, Paul.
The season, I mean, when I first saw it, I thought it was great. I didn't see the rough edges till the second time I went through it. Now this seeing is for like the third time, I could see, yeah, this season they were trying to find their feet. There are some real clunkers of episodes and real clunker of plot lines within episodes, as we've discussed on this podcast alone, that drag it down. Sometimes it goes way too melodramatic and operatic for any rationality. And sometimes the special effects have done well, and sometimes they've been dated very, very badly. And it was clearly made in a different time and with different sensibilities. It's clearly influenced science fiction cinema since, but at the time it is kind of a bridge between completely episodic and what was to come thereafter. So I was entertained watching again. It was fun.
All right. Mike?
Yeah, it does make me wonder what Babylon 5 would look like if it hadn't been made at the time and a different work of similar caliber had been made and we would have Babylon 5 now. Would it be, you know, a Showtime fully serialized kind of show where all of the episodic stuff is pulled out and it's nothing but kind of long form storytelling with a little bit of episodic bits like we see in like The Walking Dead, where there's sometimes an episode arc. Overall, I think this season very much fits its title. This is Signs Importance. It is the prelude. It is the overture. It is putting all of the pieces on the board and making sure that you care enough about these people and you start to see how they move in the world so that when things really get going, you're enough invested in a few different areas while already kind of asking interesting questions about kind of how much right do we have to dictate our culture over other people's culture. In the episode with Franklin and the young boy, we have privacy concerns with telepaths. We have some other thematic elements going on as we move through this world with these characters who, many of whom, are just trying to bring people together and find a common ground. Our aliens, sometimes not as much, but the overall oomph of the story, that this is a place of coming together, is coming out of the story already.
How about you, Sean?
Okay, well, I will say that... Babylon 5. You adorable thing. I will say that I like certain aspects of it, and while I agree with what Mike, you were saying, you know, that this is leading to bigger things, I think for me, because I'm watching this fresh, so I have a very different perspective than you two do, which is I don't have that knowledge, so I don't see all the lines. I know that there are lines here, I just don't know where they all are, and I don't know how they're resolved later. So for me, watching it fresh, I feel ambivalent, because there are aspects of the show that I really love. In terms of the way it treats some of its ideas, it's sort of that's this great mystical sort of aspect to its sci-fi nature, which I really appreciate. I like that it actually addresses the sort of world-building aspects, the sort of the cultural differences, and there is an attempt here, and at times it's really well done, where there's sort of creating relationships between the various characters, not just the main sort of human characters, but even between the humans and the aliens. And I like that this is going somewhere, that in fact it ends, at least thank God, it ends the season with leaving me with some mysteries so that I really want to watch more. But I will also say that the episodic format for me, and I think this is just a personal taste, if this show had appeared now, even with updated graphics, but had kept the episodic form, I would have quit. Because I can't do it. It drives me nuts. To be honest, the episodic form for me is something that I can only take in shows from the 90s. And then anything after that, if it's not narrative television, I have a real big problem for anything that's over 30 minutes and isn't a comedy.
So you need that serialized narrative now in your dramas, what you're saying.
Even if it's going to do the thing where it's going to have episodes, at least in some way, those episodic narratives still have to connect to the larger one somehow. Even if only that it's giving me somewhat of a reveal of new information. So like Sleepy Hollow sometimes does this, where It has an episode where it's not clear how this is connected, but actually it is. It's just not maybe a major piece, right? It's not an episode that is explicitly about the Four Horsemen. But it'll be an episode where at the end, some little detail will be released that now sort of connects with the rest. But if it was just Sleepy Hollow, where it was just like each episode was just like them fighting some random supernatural thing, I don't think I would find it as charming, except maybe because the characters are just really adorable. But yeah. I think it's the fact that it does handle its sort of narrative serial format pretty well, and has really charming characters that is a plus. I'm not saying I hate it. I'm saying that if I was still around in 1994, I probably would have loved this show if I'd actually given it a fair shake. I didn't, because I was fairly young, and also because I was watching Deep Space Nine and hating it. No, I hate Deep Space Nine. I still kind of hate Deep Space Nine. I kind of only sort of like it. It mm-hmm. suffers from the same problems, but yeah, so I mean, that would be kind of I'm sort of ambivalent. I feel good about certain aspects and I feel sort of just really put off by other aspects, but I understand that having seen this season, it is leading somewhere, and that somewhere is somewhere I'm going to like, even though I don't know where it is and you all do.
So if we weren't doing rewatching and hadn't done a little bit of investment into it, would you want to watch the show? Would you want to continue on just as a viewer?
Now?
Yeah. Yeah, from this point, are you excited to watch on?
Yeah, after Chrysalis, I want to know who the shadowy, like, weird praying mantis creatures are. I want to know who they are. I want to know what they're doing. I want to know, is there war coming? What's going to happen? So, yes.
Oh, good. Oh, good. That's the goal.
The show has done what it needed to do, which is to be exciting enough and promise more.
Yeah, I mean, but the only reason I got that is because we did this rewatch session. If we had not done this rewatch session, I think if I had tried Babylon 5 again, I would have quit after four episodes again. And
even
I think
with with Paul or me telling you to give it a little bit longer,
I think I needed to be forced a bit.
Okay.
Because like for me, it's one of those things where like my attention span for TV shows, I mean, unless I'm on a binge watch something, is really, really limited. So like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I quit after five episodes because it did not get better. I don't care what people are saying about the later episodes. I don't care how good it is. I've got time that I don't want to waste. I want to use it for other shows that I like.
So if a friend of yours said, hey, I know you did this rewatch, I'm kind of a little uncertain because I heard the show is really slow in the beginning. Like, how would you pitch this, or would you be interested in selling this to other fans at this point? Is it something that you would want other people to watch?
I think historically it's a show you need to watch at some point. If you consider yourself a sci-fi fan and you care about television, however, yeah, I think it's good enough in parts that it's worth watching. Mm-hmm. But if you put me in a battle between like this show and Battlestar Galactica and Sleepy Hollow, I would not pick this one at my current stage.
Sure, but I don't think Battlestar Galactica happens without Babylon 5. It certainly doesn't happen without Deep Space Nine because of Ronald Moore's career.
Yeah.
Well, I don't care about Deep Space Nine, so I'm still only a season and a half into that. I tried.
Well, that show eventually starts picking up some of the things that Babylon 5 does with arcs and storylines, mm-hmm. but it takes a long time for Deep Space Nine to get there. Babylon 5 does start slowly, as you've seen in this season, but it does ramp up a lot faster.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I'm not going to say I hate it. I would say that having watched the full season, I appreciate it more than I would have if I had not. And I think that's just because it starts off really rough, but it does build some really cool things by the end. That's what I would say. I think it's worth checking out, but I also want to see the rest because usually first seasons can be even good first seasons are a little rough. I think that's fair to say. Yeah.
The first season of Next Generation was really rough.
Yeah, the first season Next Generation is not that great. It does good, but yeah. But I mean, even with Sleepy Hollow, like, there's a lot of amazing stuff in Sleepy Hollow, and then there's some stuff where it's like, eh. You know, that first season's sort of like the test bed, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be perfect. Like, even Battlestar Galactica's first season's not that great. But in any case, we're like rambling. I'm rambling.
Yep. Yeah, we should probably go get down the grades and get out of here.
Okay. Well, we'll start with you, Mike. How would you grade this?
I would give this season a B because it has promise, but it hasn't become what it can or what it could be yet. So it's got some rough bits, but has promise. I was told, watch the show. And I kind of struggled through a little bit of the first season. But it did have those glimpses of possibility and promise. So I set it a B.
Sweet. All right, Paul.
I'm also going to give it a B. There are some definite C level episodes which really drag down the high points. I mean, Chrysalis is a high point. Signs Importance is a high point. We do end the season mostly on high points, but there's some stuff that's like, that is a slog to get through. It's good to have seen it. And the eternal debate, can you watch Babylon 5 without watching the first season? You can't, but there's a lot of work to be done. And yeah, when Mike reboots this in 20 years, he's going to make first season a lot better, I'm certain. But at the moment, yeah, I can't give it higher than a B.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I will say that I'll give it a B-, which is actually a pretty good grade when I think about it. But mostly for the same reasons. I think I could probably give this a B if that stupid Holy Grail episode didn't exist. If they just deleted it off of here and I'd never seen it, it would have a B. So I hate that episode so much. There are a couple episodes where, like, I just hate them because they're just bad. But that episode is just one where I hate it so much. It's so dumb. So, yeah, so a B minus. But I want to watch the rest. But I also kind of want to not watch it until if we do the second season as for the show. Because I like the idea of being fresh when we're talking about it. Because it's a different perspective.
Okay.
But maybe not. Maybe you all did. Anyway, let's shut up. All right. So on that note, if you want to leave any sort of comments or anything about any of the episodes or what we have to say, there's a number of ways you can do that. You can go to skiffingfandom.com for the specific episode. It'll usually be listed for a while on the side bar. You can also send us tweets, although they may be less effective for an argument, or an email. We're on Twitter at @SkiffyAndFanty, and our email is SkiffyAndFanty@gmail.com. And I think that's it. That's we're done, right?
Yep.
So after this, pretty soon we will actually be doing Sherlock, the BBC version. So just thought you should all know that. It's gonna be awesome. So on that note, thank you, Mike and Paul, for basically sticking this whole darn thing out with me. It was awesome.
Oh, it was a pleasure to introduce you to Babylon 5.
Yes, very fun. I apologize for the occasional spoilers along the way, but I'm so excited.
That's okay. I'll forget them in a week when final grades are submitted. So, any case, on that note, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyAndFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyAndFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyAndFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF.
There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, we have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog, too, you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skippyandfanty, sign up for 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And that, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.